This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bean Cooley, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, sitting in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to some of Terry's interview with Ryan McIlvain. He spent 2 years as a Mormon missionary in Brazil. As he went door to door, hoping to convince others to join the church, he was experiencing doubts about his own faith. McIlvain continued to experience doubts after his mission and left the church in his mid-20s. Now he's written a novel based on his experiences. It's called Elders. Elder is the term used for a young Mormon on his mission. The novel has two main characters. Elder McLeod, an American who's 18 months into his 2-year mission and longs to return home, and Elder Passos, a Brazilian who has only recently begun his mission and is passionate about it. Ryan McIlvain was born in Utah and grew up in Massachusetts. He's now living in L.A. and pursuing his Ph.D. in literature at the University of Southern California.
Ryan McIlvain, welcome to Fresh Air. This novel is inspired by your time as a Mormon missionary. Is it obligatory for young Mormon men to become missionaries?
Not quite obligatory, but it's certainly strongly encouraged for young men particularly, but more and more nowadays, young women too. It's seen as a rite of passage. It's seen as an opportunity to give a tithe of your young life, 19, 20, 21 years, to the Lord. And if it doesn't happen, there are certain taboos and raised eyebrows and cold shoulders that can greet you. So we'll say it's a culturally enforced but not obligatory rite of passage.
So talk a little bit more about what the purpose is supposed to be for the missionary and also for the larger church.
Well, the church uses the missionaries to spread the gospel, to meet certain commandments and injunctions that Jesus in the New Testament lays out. So the church is very literalist in taking the gospel to all the world, as Jesus says at the end of the Gospels. But for the young men and women themselves, I think it's an opportunity for them to grow their own testimonies, to use some of the parlance, and to try and find their faith in the exercise of it, or to try and find their testimony in the bearing of it. So you go out and you bear your testimony, and only after the fact will you discover whether or not you had one. I think that's the experience that a lot of missionaries have, and it can be very nerve-wracking at moments for that reason. You feel like you don't know the gospel or the culture that you're officially tasked with representing, and that can be very anxious for people.
What almost sounds like part of the point is for the young missionary to talk himself or herself into believing more deeply through the act of convincing somebody else to believe.
I think that's absolutely part of it. I don't know if that was, if someone who's not me would describe it in that way, and I'll have that same hesitation throughout this interview, I'm sure, but that certainly was one of the reasons that I chose to serve a mission. I was a doubter. Almost as soon as I became aware of what I believed, I became aware at maybe 13, 14 that I'd been drafted onto this team called Mormonism that was distinct from the Catholicism that was the norm where I grew up in Massachusetts. And I started to become aware of those differences, and instantly I was doubting them, at first privately, and then by the time I was in my late teens, quite vocally. But some of the people who were very close to me, my parents, certain friends in my congregation or ward, as it's called, their example meant a lot to me. And I thought, what do they know that I don't know? And so the mission for me became a chance to kind of make a large commitment commensurate to the large amount of grace I felt I needed in order to believe what seemed on the face of it unbelievable things. So that was certainly the purpose for me.
So on the cover of your novel, Elders, there's a picture of a young man in a white shirt, a black tie, and black pants, which is kind of the uniform for Mormon missionaries. How did you feel in that? Did you feel like you were wearing a uniform?
I did, but I have to say I really appreciated it because I was far from home. I was speaking a language that was foreign to me, and I was wearing an outfit that was foreign to me. So it was easy for me to slip into kind of missionary brain, whereas friends of mine who had been raised in Massachusetts, as I was, and then called to a mission in, say, Nevada, I think they had psychologically a much greater challenge. They were seeing people that looked very familiar to them. They were speaking a language that was familiar to them. But all of a sudden, they were expected to put on this entirely different mantle and this entirely different set of responsibilities. So I imagine that serving stateside, as we say, would have been much harder for me. Going to Brazil, everything in my life felt so foreign. So this was just an outgrowth of that. My missionary work was just an outgrowth of that foreignness.
One of the things you had to do in Brazil as a missionary was knock on doors and preach the faith and, you know, try to get people to convert. So how often would a door actually open, and how often would somebody invite you in to talk?
Well, more often in the reality of my mission than in the novel that I based off it. I didn't want the novel to balloon into this vast town of characters. I didn't think I had the chops to handle that big a cast. So it's fairly infrequent in elders, but in my own experience and given how sort of open to religion Brazil is compared to Massachusetts, certainly, I'd say, maybe one in 10, 1 in 15 doors.
That's not bad.
It's not a bad ratio.
It's
not. Now, what happens once the door opens is a different story. For the most part, people say, you know what, we're all set, but we appreciate what you're doing. Go with God. Again, that was the message in Brazil. In Massachusetts, it would be more curt. But it wasn't a totally humiliating, debilitating rate of success. Quite the opposite on some days. Certain friends who served in Europe or a friend of mine who went to Germany became deeply depressed after a while because you just seemed like you felt like you were wasting your time for two years. So few people were interested in hearing what you had to say.
So let's talk practically a little bit. You describe in your novel Elders a missionary handbook that forbade a lot of things. What were some of the things a missionary was forbidden to do?
A missionary couldn't read newspapers, magazines, the secular press in general. Couldn't listen to the radio, couldn't watch television, and they're also cut off from family and friends. You can write letters home to family and friends once a week, but otherwise your life is sort of constrained by the mission boundaries. Also, missionaries aren't allowed to make sort of social phone calls. It has to be business related. It has to be relating to proselytizing. So it's very militaristic. The social life of a 19-year-old, or in the case of a young woman, a 21-year-old, becomes radically interrupted for those 2 years.
And do you know what the point of that is? Cutting you off from everything?
At the risk of betraying the full extent of my cynicism, I think there's some mortification of the flesh that's involved. I also think it's a focusing mechanism. If you're meant to focus 100% on missionary work by cutting away all those distractions, it becomes easier to do that. In fact, it becomes difficult not to do that without breaking rules. So long as you're following the missionary handbook to the letter, your eye and your mind are single to the glory of God, to quote a familiar scripture.
It's also guaranteeing a certain insularity. There's no one from the outside culture who can influence you. No news coverage, no television shows, no radio, nothing with a message that might be considered subversive or taboo or just an alternative to what you believe.
I think that's true. That being said, the missionaries are still in the world. So, you know, after 9/11, I left on my mission shortly after 9/11, and missionaries were still deeply curious and concerned about what was happening back home. And so when a new crop of missionaries would come from other parts of the world and come into the mission field in Brazil, you would hear missionaries exchanging news. And so there was word of mouth, and there was certainly curiosity. But yeah, officially you weren't allowed to turn on the evening news and see what was happening in the run-up to war or to see what your favorite soccer team was doing. So yeah, you were insular, you were cut off.
So speaking strictly as an outsider who doesn't really know the literature of the Mormon Church, it seems to me that Mormons get something of a mixed message about sexuality. The founder of the church, Joseph Smith, must have had a hearty sexual urge. I would assume that he did because he had multiple wives. One would assume he had a pretty hearty sexual drive that he gave into with different women. And yet, young people like you are taught to be very wary of any kind of sexual feeling, even masturbation. Did you ever feel like you were given, looking at the history of the church, a very mixed message about sexuality?
I did feel that I was given a mixed message, and toward the end of my time in the church, I started to feel that it was a sort of double standard. Now, I think the orthodoxy would have me say that Joseph Smith's sexual relationships were all within the context of marriage, even though it was plural marriage, and some of those marriages were done in secret, and some of them would be deeply embarrassing to most members of the church. And I don't mean to say that most members of the church don't know about them, but if the fact that Joseph Smith had married, say, a 14-year-old, which is documented, if that were a common topic of conversation, it would be embarrassing to members of the church. So you had Joseph Smith's sexual behavior contrasted with the expected sexual behavior of the average young man or young woman, and you do start to see a chasm, and it can feel frustrating and a little disorienting, to be honest.
Can I ask what is sacred underwear? I think a lot of us have heard references to it, but don't really understand what it is, what it's meant to symbolize.
Well, when friends ask me, I often will relate it to, and actually I won't know the name of the garment that Orthodox Jews sometimes wear, but you have those strands that you'll sometimes see hanging out. From what I understand, the purpose of Mormon garments, temple garments, are somewhat similar. There are markings on the garments that remind Mormons of covenants they've made with God, of certain promises they've made within the temple. And it also enforces a kind of modesty. If you're wearing the garments at all time and you don't want them hanging out, which of course you don't, then the clothes you wear need to be at least as long as Mormon garments. And so this is particularly a way to enforce female modesty. So the garments go down to your knees, and on your sleeves they go about, I don't know, a third of the way down your upper arm. So in that way, Mormon women are discouraged from wearing sleeveless outfits and short skirts and shorts and so on. And, you know, to be fair, Mormon men are expected to not wear sleeveless shirts or shorts either. So to me, it serves that double function, a guard against immodesty and also a reminder of covenants.
Did you wear the sacred underwear?
While I was a missionary, yes. Yeah, I did.
And did it make you feel any more, you know, connected to God and any more loyal to promises that you'd made or whatever?
I think so. at least when you would stagger out of bed in the morning and you'd get in front of the mirror, you'd just be wearing your garments, as Mormons call them. And there were certain symbols that you'd see in the mirror, and they remind you of particular moments in a Mormon temple ceremony. And that does remind you of promises you've made. But for the most part, once you put them on and then you put clothes on over them, they just become invisible, except on a particularly hot day. And then you think, yeah, why am I wearing an extra layer of clothing? It's a bit of a cross to bear. I remember my dad, when I was a teenager, he started to be more open with me about his feelings about the church. He said, you know, I'll believe what you want me to believe, but just let me be cool and ventilated. You know what I mean? When he went through the Mormon temple, it was just one garment. It was like a jumpsuit. And nowadays it's just... It's more comfortable than that. It's just kind of like boxer shorts, basically, or boxer briefs, and just an undershirt. But at the time, I think in the 70s when he went through, it was a single garment.
In your novel, Elders, the American Mormon missionary's father is a bishop, and he knows that the son is having doubts. And so the father, the bishop, tells his son, there's nothing special in doubting. Some of my colleagues at the office are devout atheists. I think the real courage is in trying to believe. Doubt comes easy for a lot of people, but do you know what doesn't come easy? Faith, obedience, humility, self-denial, self-sacrifice. There's your courage. Were you told that?
I think I was. Not by my father, but by a number of different people, and then I kind of synthesized it for the purposes of that particular scene. But yeah, you were told that you weren't special in your doubting, and that if you did think you were special, that was an expression of narcissism. So you're told that doubt is kind of the natural state. That's the natural man that the Apostle Paul tells us we need to overcome, and that the more elevated, impressive way of being is the way of faith. If it felt natural, then it wouldn't be God's way. It wouldn't be sort of the higher, more difficult way. So it's almost like a challenge to believe, you know.
So did you have a turning point at which time you decided, this is it, I'm leaving the Mormon faith? Or was it just a very gradual falling away until you realized you were just no longer in the church anymore?
Well, I suppose it was undramatic in how gradual it was. It was sort of like a vessel filling drop by drop, and all of a sudden you realize it's overflowing, but that specific moment is hard to mark. I had stopped wearing my garments. I was no longer praying. I self-described as an agnostic, as I still do. And, at a certain moment I realized that I really didn't have anything holding me to the church anymore. And when certain relationships in my life crumbled, the social glue that had held me to the church was gone as well. And so I parted ways. I still do find that I miss certain aspects of the church. And so when my wife, also an ex-Mormon, when my wife and I go back to visit family, we'll take in a service and really enjoy the music and see old friends and appreciate that. But I can tell you that when we decided to get married, we chose not a Mormon service, but rather a more poetic, somewhat neutered Episcopalian service. So we're comfortable being sort of outside the church, but still connected to it in some ways.
After all the years of exerting so much self-control, because that was preached to you as being so important as a young man and as a young missionary, once you actually left the church, did you go through a period of like abandoning self-control and giving into extremes because it would have been more permissible?
I thought about it. I imagined it. I think I fed some of that into my fiction. But in my life, I was still very well behaved. And I think the kind of Pavlovian conditioning that I spent the first 20-odd years of my life ingraining was not going to go away overnight. I can leave the church, but I'm still going to be essentially in my being Mormon, at least in the way I behave for you know, the few years following my resignation from the church. I was still very skeptical of alcohol. It frightened me. I was afraid I would become I mean, I say this with something of a smile, but I think I was worried that I would fall instantly into addiction if I were to start drinking. And that was certainly an outgrowth of certain indoctrinations from my youth. And yeah, and there are other, I'm sure there are other vestiges of my religion that I'm not even aware of that are still very much a part of my life. So there wasn't a period of abandon. If anything, when my current wife and I met, we would ask each other, okay, now what is the secular thing to do here? We love each other. We should get married. And we'd say, no, we have to live together for a while. And and then we live together for a while, and I propose, and she says yes, and we say, okay, so now we should wait a year, right? Isn't that, you know, engagements are supposed to be pretty long, right? Well, no, let's just do 6 months. And so we're, I think we've held fast to what we still like and appreciate about the culture we were raised in, and we've jettisoned the rest. And that's a play on one of my favorite scriptures from the New Testament. Paul says to hold fast to all good things and essentially get rid of the rest.
Ryan McIlvaine is the author of the new novel, Elders. You'll find a longer version of his conversation with Terry Gross on our website, freshair.npr.org. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Johnny Cash spent 45 years in the limelight, going from country singer to American icon. And between 1958, when he first recorded for them, until 1986, when they decided not to renew his contract, Cash recorded more than 50 singles and over 60 albums for Columbia Records. Recently, Columbia collected all of those recordings in a 63-CD box set. Our rock historian, Ed Ward, spent some time digging through this rather large box.
Hello, I'm Johnny Cash.
I hear the train a-coming, it's rolling around a bend, and I ain't seen the sunshine since I don't know when. I'm stuck in Folsom Prison, and time keeps dragging on. But that train keeps a-rolling on down to San Antone. When I was just a baby.
In 1955, John R. Cash was a sometime auto mechanic, sometime appliance salesman, who liked to play the guitar and sing, mostly gospel songs. The R in his name didn't stand for anything, and in fact, he'd been named J.R. at birth and had to come up with John when he joined the Air Force. He'd spend the rest of his life reinventing himself. At first, though, what he wanted to do was make a record, so, like his picking buddy Luther's brother, Carl Perkins, John and his two-piece band went to Memphis to record for Sun Records. They did pretty well, both on the pop and the country charts.
I keep a close watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tie that binds. Because you're mine, I walk the line.
There were two things, though, that Cash wanted to do that he wasn't allowed to do at Sun. He wanted to record more gospel songs, and he wanted to make albums. It was common knowledge at the time that neither sold well enough to make them worthwhile, but Cash eventually got loose and signed with Columbia in 1958. His first album for them, The Fabulous Johnny Cash, had a smash hit, Don't Take Your Guns to Town, on it, and a couple of gospel songs, one of which was by Dorothy Love Coates, a star of black gospel.
Well, now I heard that you've been talking about me. Really, I don't mind. I know you try to block my progress a lot of the time. Well, the mean things you said don't make me feel bad, 'cause I can't miss a friend that I never had.
I've got
Jesus, and that's enough.
That's enough.
That's enough.
The next album was Hymns by Johnny Cash, and then came Songs of Our Soil, a truly weird album where Cash rewrote folk songs his own way, which was dark and cold. But he was selling plenty of records, making money on the road, and appearing on the Opry. In 1961, the Carter family joined his stage show, not the original trio, but one of them, Maybelle, and her three daughters, June, Helen, and Anita. Before long, Cash divorced his first wife and married June, beginning a partnership that would last until her death in 2003.
If I were a carpenter and you were a lady, would you marry me anyway? Would you have my baby?
If you were a carpenter and I were a lady, I'd marry you anyway. I'd have your baby.
If a tinker was my trade, would I still find you?
I'd be carrying the pot you made, following behind you.
Save your love through loneliness, save your love through sorrow. I gave you my onlyness, give me your tomorrow.
Tim Hardin's If I Were a Carpenter from 1969 was indicative of something Cash had always done, listening to all kinds of material. The album it comes from, Hello, I'm Johnny Cash, also has two songs by a studio janitor Cash had befriended and encouraged, Kris Kristofferson. Cash's liberal attitude extended to the TV series he started that year, and not only his friend Bob Dylan, but also people like Pete Seeger, Derek and the Dominoes, and, yes, Kris Kristofferson, got television exposure they'd probably not have gotten otherwise. The show lasted two seasons and is still fondly remembered. As the 1970s proceeded, Cash kept putting out records, many of them recorded in his home studio, House of Cash, where he oversaw a company whose job was keeping Johnny Cash on the road and on the radio, and buying interests in various songwriters' output. He wasn't selling multi-platinum, but few country stars were, if they weren't adhering to the new pop crossover country-politan sound, and that wasn't of much interest to Cash. He didn't care about trends and had enough power in Nashville to do what he wanted. An eccentric home movie about Jesus, the gospel road, or supporting unconventional young songwriters like Guy Clark and Billy Joe Shaver, or making concept albums held together by narrations. Or, for that matter, in 1979, recording a song by his new stepson-in-law, Nick Lowe.
Without love, I am half human. Without love, I'm all machine. Without love, there's nothing doing. I will die without love. Without love, I am an island all by myself in a heartbreak sea. Without love, there's no denying I am dying without love.
1985 brought a highly successful album, Highwayman, which put Cash and Kristofferson with Willie Nelson and Waylon Jennings for a set of songs that included the outlaw national anthem, Guy Clark's Desperado's Waiting for a Train. It went to the top slot on the country album charts, and Desperado's hit number 15 country. But as the quartet was being given its gold album, someone in the company had already decided that Cash's option wasn't going to be picked up. After 27 years, he'd been dropped. It wasn't over. He went to Mercury, although I've never heard one of those records. And then in 1993 came a series of astounding albums produced by Rick Rubin, which aren't in this box. Thanks to them, by the time he died in 2003, Johnny Cash had regained his proper place in American culture.
Fresh Air's rock historian, Ed Ward. The music he played was from the 63-CD box set, Johnny Cash, the complete Columbia album collection. Love, this is Fresh Air Weekend.
It's a burning thing, and it makes a fiery ring.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to part of Terry's interview with Jarek Bischoff. He's a musician and composer who's played with several rock bands and has composed scores for short films. Lately, he's found his music heading in a more symphonic direction. His new album, called Composed, is mostly his original songs with his own orchestral arrangements. Bischoff plays many of the instruments, but has several guest musicians, including Caetano Veloso, Wilco guitarist Nels Klein, and David Byrne, who sings on this track called Eyes.
Fascinated how your eyes go north and south beyond the temperate zone in the cool night air. In this emergency that you
Jarek Bischoff, welcome to Fresh Air. So I really like the composing you've done on this. Your background isn't in symphonic music, and you've only recently become interested in classical music. What got you excited about composing for orchestra?
Well, I came to it through a real roundabout way, where I come from a rock and roll background. And I started recording records for my bands and my friends' bands, and we kept getting more and more ambitious. So we would add a violin here and a cello there, and then just kept building these layers and layers of sound. And finally, at one point, I muted the actual rock band elements of the recording and heard this kind of orchestral thing happening, and I went, wow. That's strange. I didn't intend to do that. So yeah, right around my 30th birthday, it was when I kind of came up with this realization that I had started making orchestral music. And so I got about 35 of my friends together and rented out Town Hall in Seattle and just tried for the first time to do a orchestral show. And it was the most satisfying musical experience I had had up until then.
You compose on ukulele. Of all instruments, why the ukulele?
Well, the biggest reason is that it's super portable and I can take it anywhere. And also, a realization that I came to recently was that, bass is my main instrument. And ukulele and bass both have four strings. And to me, I really come from, orchestrally, I guess, I come from more of a soundtrack background. And whenever I think about soundtracks, I think about big, lush strings and that big Hollywood sound of the soaring violins and things like that. And so when I compose, most of the time it's very string oriented. There's not a ton of brass and woodwinds and things like that. But I realized that the cello, the viola, and then the two violin sections, you can kind of think of each ukulele string as an instrument section. Therefore, it kind of lays out a neat harmonic structure to write for strings. So it was kind of a fortuitous instrument to come across.
So, you know, when it comes time for you to do the more orchestral recordings for your album, you didn't have the money to actually hire a lot of musicians. So tell the story of what you did do to get the sound of a lot of musicians playing together.
Yeah, so I live here in Seattle, and through years and years of recording and touring and playing in bands, I realized I had this huge pool of musician friends that were insanely talented and that not only could play classical music, but had interest in rock music and all sorts of different kinds of music. And up until making this record Composed, I had always done everything myself because I was terrified to ask people to be a part of my own project. So at this point, I kind of decided, okay, never mind. I'm going to just ask everybody. And I had very limited funds to make the record, but I knew that it should be a full orchestra sound. And so what I did was I had a little laptop and one microphone that I borrowed from my friend, and first edition M-Box, which is just a thing that you plug microphones into that connects to the computer. And all that would fit into my backpack. And so I would just ride my bike over to the violin player's house and put some sheet music in front of her and have her record each part about 9 times and build the sound of a full ensemble. And then when I was done with that, then I would bike right over to the oboe player's house and have her record, and then just worked my way through the entire orchestra, just recording each individual in their own living rooms.
Let's talk about your musical background.
Mm-hmm.
Your father's a musician, your mother too?
Not my mother, no. She just puts up with all the noise, I guess. My brother is also a musician, and they're both drummers, so there's a lot of noise.
And so your father and your brother are drummers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
And you chose the quiet instrument.
Yeah. Well,
bass.
We were a family that lived on a sailboat. So we all picked really stupid instruments for living on a sailboat because they're all gigantic instruments. The tuba and upright bass being probably the biggest instruments of the orchestra, as well as percussion. And so, yeah, I don't know why we didn't all just play flutes, but that's how it happened.
How long did you live on a boat?
I think about 15 years.
Seriously, it was that long?
Yeah. From when I was about 5 until 18 or something like that.
Was it like a houseboat, or was it you were always sailing kind of boat?
It was a full-on sailboat, 37 feet long and I think about 12 feet wide. And so we mostly were moored on Bainbridge Island, at a dock, and had fairly normal lives. And then partway through high school, we took a two-year sailing trip through Central America and through the Panama Canal and into the Caribbean and stuff like that.
So where is Bainbridge Island, where you were docked most?
Bainbridge Island is a ferry right away from Seattle. So it's like 35 minutes from Seattle.
I see. So when you were 15, I think, you and your family sailed to South America?
Yes, Central America mostly, a little tiny bit of South America. But it was quite an experience.
How did you feel about leaving your friends and where you were docked?
I was miserable for about a week and a half, and then I realized, oh, I'm, snorkeling and surfing and fishing and experiencing culture every day. This is this is much cooler than hanging out at Safeway and skateboarding.
Describe the boat a little bit more.
So it's, yeah, a little sailboat. Inside, it's a little living room, which is basically a couch, I guess. And then right across from that is the galley, you know, the kitchen. And that's about 2 feet by 2 feet. And then my parents had a room at the front of the boat, which was just a bed. And then at the back of the boat, my brother and I each had our own rooms. And our rooms consisted of a floor that was about 1.5 by 1.5, and a little closet, and a couple little drawers, and then a bed that was about 7 feet long, but about 3 feet wide. So it was just kind of this little coffin that you slip into. And, you know, as a kid, I had to decide, do I want a floor to step on in my room, or do I want my bass amp and my bass? And obviously I chose to have the bass and the bass amp. So, you know, to get into bed, I would have to climb over my bass amp. And yeah, it was a strange childhood, especially, you know, because my dad is 6'6", and I'm 6'5", and my brother is 6'5", and we're all these tall dudes. There's one place in the boat where my dad could actually stand up fully, which is right in the middle of the boat there. And so, you know, we would all kind of find ourselves standing right there face to face because it was the only place we could actually all stand.
Let's talk about your father's music, because this was probably part of the music background, you know, part of the soundtrack of your childhood. He was in a band called Amra Arma.
That's right, yeah. And yeah, they were some crazy fellas.
Yeah, talk a little bit about his music.
Yeah. So, yeah, my dad plays way weirder music than I will probably ever play. He and his bandmates, to be in the band, you had to build something gigantic, basically. So some of them would build these huge synthesizers, and some of them would build enough speakers to completely surround an audience inside of a space, and some of them would build all these crazy contraptions. And back then, synthesizers weren't really a thing, and they were just starting to be developed. And so they would build these masks and create synthesizers that you could play with your tongue, and, you know, play synthesizers with their tongues while they were all beating on gigantic drum sets and things like that. And I've been told that the idea behind the band was to try to summon the essence of Conan and try to get to a point where they were playing music and they could look out into the audience and see like a Conan civilization happening.
and this is as in the comic book Conan the Barbarian, this was like before the Arnold Schwarzenegger movie.
Yes. Yeah, they were all really into comic books and things like that, obviously. and they said my dad says that they actually succeeded once, that they were playing and they all saw a Conan civilization out there. And so, yeah.
So when you were sailing around Central America, what were the musical parts of that voyage like?
We as a family kind of made a family band. And we would set up our instruments on top of the boat because we couldn't all fit down below in the boat. And sometimes we would have little concerts where everyone would take their little inflatable raft and tie up to the side of our boat with little hors d'oeuvres and cocktails and stuff like that. And then we would perform some music, and we would invite whatever other boats were around to come and join us. And so we'd had these kind of crazy concerts where 30 rafts just kind of anchored out in the middle of a bay, and we would play just whatever tunes people knew. None of our family were really that keen on singing or anything, so we were always looking for people that just happened to have an acoustic guitar on their boat and sang, and we would back them up. And a lot of Jimmy Buffett songs, of course. And of course, I didn't really listen to that music at all, and I decided I wasn't going to listen to that music. So what it forced me to do was learn how to play really quickly on my toes. I would watch their fingers and anticipate where the chords were going to go. And it was actually amazing training because I could play Margaritaville and have never heard the song and not actually miss a beat. And so
I was expecting stories about indigenous music, not Margaritaville.
Well, yeah, there was that too. There was that too. Yeah, we would go ashore and find different singers or whatever instrument and try to play with different people from villages or cities and things like that. But, you know, sadly, a lot of them wanted to play American songs, and we were always wanting to play Latin songs and things. So we would kind of trade off, and we would play a Doors song, and they would play something more traditional for them. And so I feel like my music always ends up subtly having a little bit of Latin sound in it. The rhythms and things like that, I think I'll never be able to, not that I would ever want to get rid of them, but get rid of them.
We actually have a Latin American singer on your album, Caetano Veloso.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of my favorite singers of all time.
And why is he one of your favorites?
Just his voice is so silky, smooth, and beautiful, and everything that I think of when I think of Portuguese and Brazilian music, he personifies that, and it's a beautiful sound.
Jerick Bischoff's new album is called Composed. You'll find a longer version of his conversation with Terry Gross on our website, freshair.npr.org. Here's Bischoff's song featuring singer Caetano Veloso. It's called The Secret of the Machines.
Torn from the mountainside, and the mine we melt in the pit. Cast wrought and hammered there, by design we're cut, tooled and fitted. We can pull and haul and push, lift, drive, grip, plow and weave and light. We can run and race and swim, fly, dive, see, hear and count and write.
Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Nell Beschenstein is our associate producer for online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.